Hi, everyone. This is Carrie Cassidy from Project Camelot, and I am here with Tony Gosling, and we're going to be talking about things Bilderberg and also what's going on around the world. Some updates, I'm going to ask him about his view as an ex-BBC journalist, what he thinks went on with the BBC over the years, also what's currently going on now with the financial system, the situation in Syria and Turkey, and actually more, also Crimea. There's a huge world stage that we're looking at, and Tony will be a great person and a great resource in this area. So I want to introduce everyone to Tony Gosling. If you're not familiar with his work, he is an ex-BBC journalist, as I said, considers himself a British lands rights activist and a historian. And I'm reading a sort of skimming a bio you've got here, exposing the secret power of the Bank of International Settlements, BIS, the elite Bilderberg conferences. And this is basically, as everyone knows, where the dark forces of corporations, media, banks, and royalty conspire to accumulate wealth and power through extortion and war. Tony has spent much of his life advocating solutions that heal the wealth divide, such as free housing for all, and a press that is concerned with the what goes on with ordinary people and not just opinion sensationalism or dumbing down. And he has his own radio show. It looks like it's called BCFM, not to be confused with BBC. And it looks like it's on Friday and dealing with politics. So welcome, Tony, and let me get you on the screen here.
Hi, Carrie, and hi, everybody. Thanks very much for that introduction. What was one thing I would point out is that, actually doing journalism for me has been a hell of a struggle, really, just trying to tell the truth. And I see myself in the kind of George Orwell tradition in realizing that actually there is a massive, massive, powerful establishment out there that is really trying to control not only what we see and hear in our news every day, but actually controlling history, how we understand how we've got to where we are, and really trying to make sure that very few ordinary people actually understand how the world really works. We're basically looking at most of the national media in the Western world is just giving us a completely false picture of who is running things, and how we can participate in society is just not explained to us at all. And that's all quite deliberate, of course.
Absolutely. Well, in terms of you leaving BBC, this may be old ground for you, but how long have you been gone from the BBC? And can you explain why you left or under what circumstances?
Well, I left the BBC in 1993. I've been working there for 3 years. I spent a year and a bit working in one of the main London newsrooms for the big radio station, BBC Radio Station 4 London, which was called Greater London Radio. I mean, we had an absolutely massive listenership into the millions, and I was working with some top well-known DJs, a guy called Johnny Walker, who was on pirate radio here in Britain back in the 60s and 70s. Also, Tommy Vance on his show, who was a rock, a kind of rock DJ. But, you know, what they did on GLR was a really powerful stuff. You know, it was fantastically powerful stuff because it was a mixture of really good music. And in between the songs, you'd get powerful interviews, you know. And actually, what we did was proper journalism. That is to say, any big story, we would try and show both sides. So, for example, I was working there during the first Gulf War, and we actually got an Iraqi who was living just around the corner from our radio station and got him, and he really liked Saddam Hussein. And one of his friends had written a biography, a very positive biography about Saddam Hussein. We got him on the radio, you know, just talking. And there were a few eyebrows raised. Now, we're just going to war with these people, and you've got someone who really likes them. But that's good journalism. You know, the idea, and I think this is a major thing for everybody in almost all of our lives and in civil society, is to be reflective. That is to say, to be self-critical and to be able to look at your own faults. And I think we're in a world now, Kerry, where the media is just not interested in the faults in the home countries. what it is, it always wants to point the finger abroad, whether it's Iran, Russia, China, anywhere else but here. And we really need to do that if we're going to survive as a species.
No doubt about it. So in terms of the world stage at the moment, there is a lot going on, needless to say. And there's also new information about some George Soros leaks regarding what went on in the Ukraine. And I'm not sure, but he could be involved in the Crimea situation that's sort of starting to sort of ramp up, if you might call it that. So can you take a look at the world stage for us and see where you're seeing, because you did contact me about sort of wars starting the way you're seeing it. And of course, we've got ongoing skirmishes constantly in the Middle East and elsewhere. How do you see it?
Well, the skirmishes are also taking place at the Olympics. We've got biased judges. I've just been reading literally earlier today about the bias against athletes from Russia and from Iran, countries like that. The judges are just making ridiculous decisions about, you know, blocking people who seem to have won games. So the skirmishes are, because it seems that both in Ukraine and in Syria, the West is being blocked from trying to expand its empire. I mean, you know, we can go back, aren't we, to the Romans almost, and look at the empire the Romans had. You can look at the empire, the British Empire. We now seem to have something which is almost along Roman Empire lines, and that's the US Empire. And it's expanding. You know, we've got these military bases popping up all over the world, and particularly around Iran, you know, and to try and dominate the Middle East. And that seems to me so hypocritical for the Americans to be pointing the finger at Russia and saying, hang on, you're refueling an Iranian airbase to try and take out ISIS. And yet you look and you think there's actually hundreds of US bases all over the place. And yet you're pointing the finger at this one base. So I think obviously on the military scheme of things, Ukraine and Syria are the hot spots, but because there's been it's been very difficult for the American Empire and the British Empire, in a way, of course, together NATO, which is a completely unaccountable organisation, a terrorist organisation, in my view, which has completely overstretched its remit. There's no real reason for NATO, I think, to exist anymore. But they've been blocked in those two places at the moment, and so the effort is going into all parts of civic society, including the Olympics, including the United Nations, domination of key committees, the Israelis taking over the Judicial Committee at the UN. They're doing everything they can to take over all the globe's other civil society organizations and to use those against the Russians, Chinese, and the Iranians and the rest of the world. But you can't isolate. This seems to be a completely flawed tactic of the British, US, NATO empire, Israeli empire, which is to try and isolate everybody that doesn't agree with them. So they're trying to isolate Iran, they're trying to isolate Russia, they're trying to isolate China in the South China Sea, in the Spratly Islands. They're trying to isolate everybody that won't do as they want them to. And of course, what's happened is the obvious, what should have been obvious from the word go, which those various isolated independent nations are starting to come together. I mean, we saw the BRICS countries, then there's the Chinese Development Bank, which has started. What's happening is all those countries they've tried to isolate are now getting together and forming, an alliance against this NATO empire and the Israeli empire. And that's why it worries me, because it seems that ultimately there's going to be a world war kind of conflict between these two enormous great superpowers, possibly with the Chinese on the Russian side, but it's by no means clear what China will do.
Okay, well, this has been sort of in the offing for quite some time, and I appreciate your analysis there. What are you thinking in terms of how the financial downturn works into this situation? Because, you know, you're looking, you're someone who went to the Bilderberg meeting. Well, not, I assume you weren't allowed inside, but like myself, you were on the outside, on the fringe, as they call it. And, you know, rather recently, and we tried to get in touch with you then. But the fallout is what we're experiencing now from that meeting. So any decisions that were made, you know, you can appreciate that they're influencing affairs at this time. So how are you seeing this situation, for example, with Turkey now getting closer to Russia and a complete reversal in a sense?
Well, Turkey always was going to be a problem because, of course, NATO is attacking Muslim countries and Turkey is a Muslim country and it's supposed to be part of NATO. So, you know, always going to be a problem right on the far eastern fringe of NATO. And I think I'm not saying that I think Turkey has had enough of NATO. I don't think it has. But certainly there is going to be, I think, a certain amount of peace now breaking out and better relations, rapprochement between the Turks and the Russians, the same as between the Germans and the Russians. I mean, it's pretty clear that the main Pentagon aim and the main Bilderberg aim, actually, I mean, I'll talk about how that fits in a minute, is to put a wedge between the Turks and the Russians, to put a wedge between the Germans and the Russians, most importantly. They're scared to death that the Germans and the Russians will start trading, will get along fine, and will almost be part of a kind of international power bloc. I think that's the main aim, it seems, of all Western foreign policy at the moment, is to stop the Germans getting a good relationship with the Russians. It's almost like a kind of rerun of the Second World War, isn't it? You know, where you know, there was this supposed friendship between Stalin and Hitler, and then Hitler turned on Stalin. Well, I mean, it's actually not just recently that Russia has been the target. It goes right way back to Napoleon, of course, or, you know, hundreds of years ago. Anyway, with the Bilderbergs, I mean, when I was there back in the beginning of June, before the Brexit vote, I had the great displeasure to meet two of the Bilderbergs on the outside, because there's this bizarre situation, Kerry, where they've got all these hundreds of German police surrounding the conference centre right in the middle of Dresden. And this is a big posh hotel they're in. And yet the Bilderbergers, when they feel like it, just kind of wander around. You know, you think, well, what is the point of all the security? You're just going to come out through the security cordon and go and buy an ice cream or whatever it is. You know, they were going to visit various museums on the fringes there. Of course, it's a kind of sham to have all that security when you don't really need it. A lot of the security were hassling journalists. They were arresting people who had come to protest just for holding up a placard and that sort of thing. So, and I had the great, as I say, displeasure to meet two of the major participants in the Bilderberg conference. Not that they had a lot of much to say to me, but it was almost like their body language said it all. I asked them both about Brexit, what they thought about Brexit, and the idea of Britain leaving the European Union, and I got the absolutely stony omerta from them. They didn't want to talk. I mean, they would say go away and things like this, and this is a private place when it wasn't. I mean, we were in
all right. Business. And are you naming names at all? Who are these two people?
Yeah, I spoke to Jacob Wallenberg. Many people have never heard of Jacob Wallenberg, but he's the most powerful man in Sweden. He runs the banking system in Sweden pretty much. His family have for many years. He's featured, by the way, in an excellent book. I would recommend every single American to read this book. And it's called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And it's written by Paul Manning, who was CBS's main news correspondent during the Second World War from the European front, the Western Front. And he was reporting, you know, every day, every morning on the news in the US as to what had been going on in the Western Front. Of course, very few people alive now that remember what he sounds like. But in the 1980s, early 80s, his swan song really was this book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And the Wallenberg family feature in that book because they did exactly what Royal Dutch Shell did during the Second World War. They basically split the company into two, had two people, one person running each side of the company. And so whatever happened at the end of the war, they were going to make a fortune. They just made sure that they were working with both sides during that war. And the Wallenbergs did exactly the same in Sweden and made a fortune, of course, out of the war, as most bankers do out of these wars. As Smedley Butler is always reminding us, a US general, pre-war general that helped stop the coup in 1933 against Roosevelt, that is a racket. And Wallenberg just didn't want to talk to me at all. He said, this is private, blah, blah, blah. But it's just the body language, Kerry.
And when sure.
As soon as I mentioned the word Brexit, it was just like, oh, God, that's the last thing I want to talk about. Now, these people, they do not consider the idea that a democratic vote here in Britain to say we've had enough of the European Union is not in their purview whatsoever to think about these things. They have decided the way that the world is going to run, and the idea that people might decide differently, they don't even think about it. They don't consider it. The other guy I spoke to was James A. Johnson, who you may know as Goldman Sachs director, who's basically Hillary Clinton's bagman, and he was for Obama too. So these are the people that do all the fundraising, basically the millions and millions and probably billions of dollars that it costs now to get yourself elected as president with all the dirty tricks, as we've heard at the Democratic National Convention, etc. I mean, there is no democracy, as we know. And one of the Germans who I met there, he was a young student back in the about 2000, maybe late 1990s, at one of the peace institutes. I think it was the Hamburg Peace Institute in Germany. And he'd been inquiring into the Bilderbergs in the mid-1990s. Now, his professor actually threw a wobbly. Basically, he started screaming at this student, "You cannot investigate Bilderberg. These people decide on peace and war." and they have billions and billions. And if you find anything out about Bilderberg, then you may be in big trouble. So this is the way his professor at the Peace Institute is talking about these Bilderbergs.
Right.
And that guy's Klaus Kopp. I did a few interviews and I put them online. And there's a series of interviews. If anyone wants to listen to some of the most interesting and best people that I met back in Dresden, talking about the whole context of the Bilderberg conferences to share with the world. It's called Bilderberg Exposed in Dresden. Just put that into YouTube or somewhere else on the internet.
Okay, great.
A series of interviews with, and then one of the best was with a guy called Rich Newland, who's an American who's working in Germany. He was involved in some, or his family were involved in some pretty dark stuff that's been going on in the States. Maybe that was one of the reasons he was in Germany. But he was saying that he thinks there's going to be kind of global civil wars, setting people against each other right the way around the Western world in order to try and ferment big changes so that the one world government, effectively the sort of new world order, can get their way. Order through chaos.
Absolutely.
This professor from Klaus Kopp, by the way, even pointed at him and said, "Where do you live? Where do you live?" And that was just for literally for asking if he could do his thesis on the Bilderberg. So
yeah.
That's where we are. You know, it's a crazy situation, but I'm afraid, academia does not want to know about this stuff at all, even though it's the most important. I would suggest Bilderberg is where the Western world is run from. If you go into, for example, the P2 Lodge in Italy in the 1980s, the exposure of this Masonic Lodge, which was running Italy, it had all the top newspaper bosses, all of the top bankers, all of the top right-wing politicians.
P2 is still very much in operation. My understanding is their headquarters is actually in the south of France.
But I think it's pretty sure. Well, it may not, because it may be another lodge. I think most regions of Europe, certainly, I don't know about the States, but certainly most regions of Europe, including Britain, are run like this. I think you've got effectively a secret government behind the scenes, people who are part of a religious cult or secret societies, and then they effectively just make big decisions. And the EU is definitely part of that. And this is one of the things that Paul Manning was writing about in Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. It was because the loot that the Nazis had got from the Second World War, from looting all of the vaults of the European capitals, they basically spirited it all away to South America, most of it, a lot of it to Switzerland, and then laundered that money through Sullivan and Cromwell, the Dulles Brothers law firm in New York, and they started a kind of secret financial empire, which was with Jews on the boards of these organizations in order to disguise the fact that it was Nazi money that was behind them. And Paul's book is just wonderful. He looks, for example, at the snatching of Adolf Eichmann from South America and bringing him over to Israel to be executed, stand trial, the architect of the final solution. Eichmann was. And the most interesting part of the book, in a way, is the way he explains how that time was when Israel lost its soul, because once Eichmann had been executed, the message went out very, very loud and clear from the Jewish community around the world and from this Bormann network that the funds, if this ever happened again, the funds to Israel would dry up. Also, Issa Harel, who was the Mossad officer behind the kidnap of Eichmann, was then sacked or asked to leave. And so no more of this hunting Nazis around the world was going to happen by the Israelis. I mean, obviously, the Americans and the British had given up on it, you know, almost from the word go. But there was a deal done, I would say, even in 1944, between the Nazi-leaning allies, and I'm saying mostly America and Britain. I'm talking about, obviously, Prescott Bush and the people who were behind the 1933 coup in the States, coup attempt against Roosevelt. There were plenty of them.
You know, don't forget Churchill's role, because...
I was going to say, and also Winston Churchill. I mean, there were several others. There was Montague Norman at the Bank of England. We had King Edward VIII, who was definitely a Nazi. He had a Nazi girlfriend. He wanted to actually get to Nazi Germany so he could broadcast to Britain over the airwaves, I suppose, like Lord Haw-Haw, and tell all the British people to give up and do what the Nazis wanted them to. That was our king here in Britain. So there was a very strong Nazi faction here. There was Oswald Mosley, whose son, Max Mosley, was very big in motor racing here in Britain, etc. And he's now he's the financial backer of the deputy leader of the Labour Party, would you believe? So, you know, these family things go on and on.
Well, I mean, Jim Mars, you're familiar with Jim Mars's work. He's done a number of books basically talking about the Fourth Reich, which is, in essence, what we've got now operational and certainly running America. There's no doubt about it. As far as I'm concerned, the Luciferians are running Britain with some Nazi help, and so it goes across Europe. But, you know, it is a game that was played with Hitler as a kind of a pawn initially by the Western powers and by the Bilderberg group. And then Hitler basically went off the reservation and got out of hand, just like Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi, if you will. And so this is their MO. They set these guys up and then they have to take them down because they end up sort of getting a lust for power and getting, you know, sort of seeing that they may be able to push their agendas, their own personal agendas. It is a whole scenario. It involves, on the highest level, various ET races. Whether or not you are aware of that side of things, I don't know. Are you at all?
I disagree with you. I think that's a distraction from what's going down here on Earth. Planet Earth, I think, is where the big bad beastie boys are. And there is a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes. I think there's also quite a lot which is put out to kind of distract people. In a way, this whole ET thing, I'm sorry to disagree with you, but I have
No, it's fine. You're welcome to do it.
I think what they're trying to do is to almost to say, well, actually, we are just these kind of tiny little people down here. There's not much we can do. And there's all this stuff going on, you know, extraterrestrial or far away. And they're kind of looking at us, managing us. No, I don't think so. I think every single individual on this planet has actually got a role to play in all this. And I think that the ET thing does, I'm not saying, you know, 100%, but I think it does kind of distract us away from what's going on here politically, emotionally, you know, and particularly in the media, because the media is a big, big thing that these guys target. You'll see loads of the media at the Bilderberg conferences, but they never write anything honest about what's going on there. They're there, really, I suppose, to kind of, instruct the people who are being brought on as new politicians. Bilderberg is a kind of recruiting place. It's where they just look at these new politicians they think are up and coming. Are they going to be any good? Do we want them to become the next leader of the US, Britain, France, Germany? I mean, for example, there was the German defense minister, a woman, who was sitting next to Henry Kissinger, and everyone after that was a leak that came out of the hotel. So now everyone is pointing to her as taking over from Merkel. And Merkel sort of, she's kind of politically rather almost had it, I would say. So, you know, these are the sort of things that happen there.
Well, are you aware of this, basically what we call the black magicians operating behind the scenes to orchestrate some of these things? Are you aware of their desire to set up female, in essence, leaders of the United States and Great Britain and a triangle to include initially Angela Merkel, but you say there's another woman that may come to the fore in Germany. They have to have a triumvirate because they're trying to access the divine feminine at this time. There's a shifting of the energies on the planet. Have you become aware of any of that?
Well, I don't know necessarily. I wouldn't necessarily agree with you on that. I mean, I would say.
Are you aware of the black magicians in behind the scenes?
Well, I think I'm quite certain that there is black magic going on here. I mean, certainly the way Freemasonry has changed and contacts I've had in Freemasonry over the years always report the same thing. Basically, since the 1950s, roughly, the Masonic lodges who were run by decent, honest people, some of them Christians, even though they were Masons, one by one, these Masonic lodges have been basically taken over by people who are just there for avarice. And slowly but surely, Freemasonry is being turned from an organization which was actually in its time. And if you think about when it started in the so-called 1700s, I mean, it goes back a long way further than that. But formally, there was a very little tolerance. There were religious puritanical attitudes were horrendous, certainly here in Britain they were. And actually, Masonry served a useful purpose in that people could kind of go in there and have a kind of speakeasy, and they knew that they weren't going to be persecuted by any of the religious authorities and political authorities and the monarchy, for example.
To get into what we're talking about has to do with black magic, has to do with accessing what is, in essence, the orgone energies of children. We've got a lot of basically Satanism going on, as well as pedophilia in the top ranks of power within both Britain, the United States, and the rest of Europe. So are you aware of this? Because pedophilia is a key sort of a bell ringer, if you will, with what has been going on in Britain and behind the scenes.
We've got here a child sex abuse inquiry, which has been completed. I mean, when I was working in London in the BBC back in the early 1990s, I was told by many sources that there were, you know, sex scandals that were being covered up, etc. And the finger was pointed at several people who were very high up in that government at the time, the John Major government. But what's been happening is every now and again a bit comes out and then it gets squashed. A bit comes out and it was squashed. The big thing, obviously, was the Jimmy Savile expose. And what's happened since then is rather what's happened in Egypt, which it sounds crazy, but, you know, when Morsi came to power and the Muslim Brotherhood, this was a proper democratic election. Not everyone agreed with it. Fine. But, you know, he's going to make some real big changes. And as soon as he tried to start taking on the justices, the judges in Egypt, there was a coup by Mubarak's defense minister, came in and took over. And what they then did is they looked at all the people who'd been proactive in the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood, and that is to say people who cared, yeah, really cared, and then they just arrested them. A lot of them they just executed. So it was an excuse, the so-called Arab Spring, to identify people of goodwill and execute them. And that's what we have had essentially.
Well, that's an interesting take. I have to say that, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood was also quite right wing and also had to do with a lot with wanting to bring in Sharia law. Egypt has always been a very international country, and I don't think the people were in favor of that at all.
They certainly were in favor of the Muslim Brotherhood and Morsi. And I think also the other thing is that the Muslim Brotherhood and Morsi could have been a very powerful counterforce to people like ISIS. I don't think, I mean, there was some talk of them getting involved in Syria, but I don't think that they would be going along with the stuff that's happening now. Certainly the mass bulk of the Muslim Brotherhood wouldn't, maybe Morsi himself. But no, he was, I mean, what you have to, I mean, there's a lot of people who are critical of that time, but the Brotherhood were a little bit like Hamas and people like this, organizations that are created by Western intelligence, but then they just kind of go native. they get so many people supporting them that they then sort of go off in their own direction, and Western intelligence doesn't control them anymore.
Well, I mean, you're also telling the story of ISIS. I mean, we know that they're funded and up, you know, and were started by the West.
I still think they are controlled by the West. I don't think there's Baghdadi, for example, you know, who they all swear allegiance to in a kind of Hitlerian SS fashion. This guy is still working for the West, as far as I can see. I can't understand why anyone doesn't see that. And we've just had, yes, over the last week, a rebranding of al-Nusra, which is this ISIS light, al-Qaeda in Syria, calling themselves the Sham Liberation Front. And I just could not believe this, Kerry, when I first saw it. I mean, the Sham Liberation Front. Is this the global elite sticking two fingers up at us, having a laugh with the entire world? Also, ISIS as well, of course, is from ancient Egypt, and a lot of these people worship ancient Egypt. We started, didn't we, thousands and thousands of years ago in ancient Egypt with worshipping gods with animal heads. Then we kind of, humanity progressed a little bit to the Romans and the Greeks, where they were worshipping gods with human heads and were worshipping planets and things like that too. And now it seems we've got a situation which is a sort of throwback to those times, these people that kind of worship these old forms of religion. But the people that seem to be now, almost like they think of themselves as Roman emperors, as gods themselves, Kerry.
Well, I think, you know, this gets into, appreciate your take on the ET situation, but I don't agree with it, obviously. I think the secret space program factors into politics a lot more than people on, you know, involved on your level usually admit to. And I am curious whether or not you've done any research in this way, because when you say they're going back to old religions, what we're really talking about is them relating to basically these ET handlers that were behind the scene from day one, dealing with a lot of, basically genetically, dealing with humanity, manipulation, et cetera. So this whole movement towards sort of obfuscation and not understanding where one thing comes out of another, it's very important to go into the background of what's really motivating these people. It's not just simply things like traditional ideas of things like greed or, wanting more money. They've got plenty of money. They've got other agendas, and those agendas involve going off planet, setting up off planet civilizations, changing humanity, using artificial intelligence to do so, as well as things like nanotechnology and so on.
Yeah. So, more simply, I would say power. They're drunk on power like it's heroin, and they can't get enough of it. They just want more and more and more of it. And I think this is also part of this kind of I'm a god myself. It's this kind of blasphemy, which is a sort of, isn't this the sort of thing which would... it's an atheistic thing, actually. It's where you don't believe that there's any kind of higher spiritual force, maybe Satan, I'm not sure, or Lucifer.
Well, basically it's Luciferianism, where you believe in the mirror, what's called the mirror, the reflection of God, which is in essence your own ego. So yes, there's an obsession of these individuals, especially the black magicians. This is the road they go down.
Let's get back down to earth a little bit, because you talked about the economy. And one of the things that we were discussing a lot, the people who were at the Bilderberg conference, and I'm talking about effectively sort of journalists from around Europe. There were a few there. I had a chat. Some of the journalists didn't even know what was going on. We were actually telling the police what was happening. And one of the police said to me, "Oh, does that mean that there's no point in voting?" Well, yes. And the guy, Klaus Kopf, I was talking about earlier on, this guy, the professor, screamed at him and said, "Do you think the American president is really voted in?"
Well, that's very good. Well, I mean,
that know that democracy is a sham.
Yes.
The thing is, the London media and the Washington media are just simply not telling us.
Yeah, well, I mean, this goes for Britain the same way. Let me say, though, that I wonder if you're aware, Simon Parkes, who is somebody, I don't know if you're familiar with Simon Parkes. He was a former British councillor in Northern England. He's no longer doing that job, but he's quite an outspoken critic at this time. and he gets insider information. One of the things he was told was that Brexit was actually orchestrated from the very top levels, that they wanted Britain to leave. That was their plan.
So, and I don't think we are necessarily going to leave, even though there was a referendum vote. They're now talking about 2020 before they even trigger Article 50, which will begin the process.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. So that's actually what I predicted myself. Yeah,
they're trying to put it off. I mean, no, I think the referendum vote was a genuine reflection of opinion here. We are much more interested, even though they're a toxic lot, in being ruled from Westminster than we are from Brussels. Just generally as a people. That was the main issue, it's about who's running things. I mean, it's a little bit like, in a way, you can maybe have a referendum, maybe you should do in the US, saying, do we want the individual states to have sovereign power rather than have the people in Washington, the federal government, have they made a mess of things, and should we just take our power back to individual states? And I think if people were given that opportunity in the US, they'd probably say it too.
Well, actually, I mean, I think that to some degree, power, wherever it resides on the planet at this time, is basically orchestrated by some very distinct groups. And those groups are operational both on state level and on the federal level. Yeah. So I don't think Britain's that much better off, to be honest with you. In fact, it may be the opposite case if Brexit were to actually be carried out. But I appreciate that you as a Brit might like to have that point of view.
Because Britain is going to be punished for this financially. There's going to be an absolute fist coming down on Britain because they have made the wrong decision. This is the way these things work. The other thing about the European Union is that this is one of the things that Paul Craig Roberts and others have pointed out, is that the whole formation of the European Union happened originally with the Treaty of Rome in 1958, which started the whole process, was funded, all the work that went into that was funded by the CIA, because the US government wanted to have one embassy to talk to. It was fed up with the idea of having to pick up the phone to 30 different embassies all across Europe and get them to agree to anything. They just wanted to make one phone call. Right, you're going to do this. And can we do that? And let's do this. And so they had to.
Well, certainly none of this operates. I mean, Britain has never been run by the United States. I mean, actually, there is some distinction as to whether or not it's the reverse. Her Majesty's law is basically the law of the sea, and it's basically what is being put down around the world. But to get into that discussion, it doesn't really, in other words, we're kind of, we're talking about, evil on both sides of the Atlantic for all intents and purposes.
Concentration of power into a United States of Europe. That's what they wanted, to have a kind of, on the US model, the same kind of thing going on in Europe.
Do you really believe that the corporations running the world at this time, which is really what's going on, are going to allow the dissolution of Europe? I understand that there's a move in that direction, but the reality is that I don't think that's going to happen, because corporations simply won't stand for it.
Well, I think the corporations would love it, because the corporations are just like the Americans I was just talking about, only want to go and lobby one place. They want to get the law changed right across Europe just like that, because they've seen how easy it is.
Well, that's, in essence, you're agreeing with me then. Basically, they don't want to see the dissolution of the European Union. So, in essence, we do have a lot of resurgence of the whole kind of Nazi playing field, and you yourself have done some research in this area. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I mean, mainly really through looking at what happened in the Battle of Arnhem in 1944, September 1944. It was really towards the end of the Second World War, just a few months to go before the end, maybe 6 months to go before the end. And it was after D-Day when the US and British troops invaded the continental Europe. And there was a few stages to this. There was in August 1944, there was something called the Falaise Gap Battle, which was really where the Germans made their final attempt to throw the Americans and the British back to the coast, and they failed. And around about that time, there was something called the Red House meeting in Strasbourg, the Red House Hotel, where Martin Bormann, who was Hitler's number two, effectively his deputy. In fact, by this time, Bormann was really pulling the strings. I mean, he had been for many years. And in fact, he managed to get Rudolf Hess out of Germany on a stupid flight in 1941, who was the only other person who was as close to Hitler as Bormann was, out of the way. So he had Hitler to himself. But there were attempts to, you know, make out that Bormann had died at the end of the Second World War, and that was largely orchestrated by the British.
Well, I mean, Hitler didn't even die, sure, you know that, right?
No, I don't necessarily believe that, because I think that well, I mean, there is, I know Peter Levender and others have done some work on this.
A tremendous amount of work has been done in this area.
No, I don't necessarily agree with that, and I'd be interested to see your evidence, but I think what's happened is, the myth is being perpetrated that Hitler survived and Bormann died. I think it's the other way around, a bit like 9/11 with no planes at the Twin Towers. Actually, there's no plane at the Pentagon, no plane on Building 7, you know. So the idea is to try and twist the truth, you know, at a very fundamental level to make it difficult for people to understand. Bormann was the money man, and he controlled billions of pounds, Deutschmarks, whatever, of wealth from Europe. And the British actually helped get him out right at the very end of the Second World War. This is described brilliantly in a book called Op JB by Christopher Crichton. That's his pen name, of John Ainsworth Davies, who was a commando, young commando, who went in there with Ian Fleming. Ian Fleming wasn't part of the actual getting him out, but Ian Fleming went in, you know, the James Bond writer.
Yes.
Get Bormann out. And brought him over to Britain. They took him out through Berlin on canoes, actually right under the noses of the Russians, who were in the process of just getting into the Reichstag, or the Reich Chancellery, which was where they were based. And then he was brought to the UK. And then that book, Op JB, describes that part of the process by the British. It was Churchill was involved. Very, very much in this operation, secret operation, and also a guy called Major Desmond Morton, who was the head of M Section, MI6. And if you look at all these James Bond novels that Ian Fleming wrote after the war, because, you know, after the war, Fleming was a bit of a drunk, basically. And he was in a bad state, very demoralized. You know, no one could kind of get anything much out of him. He was from the banking family, the Fleming banking family, of course, which is why he was part of the elite and trusted with these secrets. But then he started to write. He started to write. Someone suggested to him, look, you should just write books. You know, like Dennis Wheatley and other people who were at the heart of the British war machine started writing books after the war. In fact, Wheatley had written books before the war too. And so this helped Ian Fleming get this off his chest, you know, and he could get it out in fiction. And in those books, there's a lot of kind of coded stuff about what was going on.
Yes, I've interviewed Mike Sparks. Are you familiar with him? He's something of an expert on this.
Very, very interesting guy.
Yeah.
He's absolutely on the ball with a lot of this stuff.
Yes.
And so M Section MI6, which really existed in the Second World War, which snatched Bormann from the middle of Berlin just as the Russians were closing in, with his signatures and with his bank accounts and everything. So M Section was really the model for the you know, many of the Fleming novels. In fact, actually, Moonraker, I think it is one which gives most clues about the connection with the Nazis. You know, and it's a lot of it is in there, and that was, and then of course once Bormann comes to Britain, there are a lot of questions about where Britain got the money for it developing the atomic bomb. It wasn't passed by Parliament. Nobody.
Aware of Project Paperclip and all of that?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And what happened was then at that point, Bormann was taken, this is probably in the early 50s, maybe even in the late 1940s, was taken over to South America and spent the rest of his life over there. And that, at which point, good old Paul Manning, I was talking about earlier on from CBS, takes up the story. So those two books, I mean, you know, most people don't have time to read books, but, or can't be bothered or whatever, that I would suggest everybody, every American should read those two, because
okay,
it gives you a really interesting insight into the stuff which there was a massive attempt, and there still is actually, to keep this stuff secret.
Sure.
Last year I was invited down to Hayling Island, which is near the Isle of Wight, the south coast of Britain, to a wonderful event, which was to commemorate the life of Commander Golding, Goulding was the head of coastal forces for the British Navy during the war. He did more raids on the coast of Europe than anybody else at all. And yet at the end of the war, he suddenly died. Nobody really knew why. His granddaughter, Jill, who's around, you know, she runs a bed and breakfast down in Hayling Island, she has managed to, she found a suitcase in her grandmother's loft, which had documents from her grandfather. And bizarrely, there's all this secret documentation in there about his role in the secret stuff. It turned out that he was the commanding officer who trained the commandos that went over to snatch Borman. And it seems pretty clear what happened, that he started to get annoyed about all this. He's saying, look, hang on a minute, we're snatching this Borman guy, but we're letting him keep the money. What's going on? So as soon as he starts to ask questions about that, suddenly he keels over. So there is all sorts of, you know, it's a long time there's been efforts to keep this quiet. In fact, there's still some people who are trying to keep Jill quiet. But, you know, we had a quite lovely ceremony last year. So these two books, Op JB by Christopher Crichton, whose real name is John Ainsworth Davis, and Paul Manning's Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile, will give you a whole massive insight. And it's really cartels that Paul Manning's talking about. That is to say, the Krupps cartel, the steel cartels in Germany, wanted a kind of United States of Europe where, when they took over these countries, they could just impose this cartel system where people would just have to pay whatever the cartels told them. And many people just point to the European Union as mimicking exactly what Borman and the rest of them intended for occupied Nazi Europe. The European Union are doing it today.
Yes, absolutely. Following a playbook right down the road. So in terms of the financial situation, I know you've spent some time looking at this. Can you tell me what you see in the next few months to the year coming down? Because there's a lot of predictions. Everyone seems to see something a bit different. What's your take on things?
Well, one of the most fascinating bloggers, and I would recommend everyone in the world to go to the Bilderberg conferences, because you meet so many interesting people on the outside in the bars and the pubs around. With this guy, Manfred Petrisch, who runs something in German. It's called All Smoke and Mirrors, Alles Schau und Rausch blog. And he was a Swiss banker. He's now retired, but then he became a 9/11 truther. One of his clients had been in the Twin Towers, had worked there, etc., and was telling him, look, this thing didn't happen, whatever. He was explaining to him. And one of the things Manfred said is, well, the whole Western economy can go any second. And of course, he's right. Any time that the banksters choose, they can just bring the whole entire house of cards right down. And yes, that is we're in a very, very dangerous time, because I think that's definitely going to happen at any time. I mean, any time now. Of course, we had the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers a couple of years ago formed a joint company for the first time so that they could take advantage of distressed assets. So when people have to sell because there's no the economy is in such a terrible state, that they can buy them up cheap. You know, these people are really cynical gangsters, effectively. So I think financially what we're going to see is we're going to see some kind of war breakout somewhere, and then we're going to see financial collapse blamed on the war. Now, that financial collapse is going to happen anyway. I mean, some people in this country were saying, oh, if we do Brexit, it might cause a financial collapse. Well, you can point the finger at whatever you want at the moment. What no one wants to point the finger at is the regulators and the bankers. And I always talk about the Bank for International Settlements, because our governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, now is from the Bank for International Settlements. This is, maybe you should look for your ETs there, because that is where all the banking regulation for the world really takes place. The Russians and the Chinese are starting to back away, and other countries are backing away from the Bank for International Settlements. But they do all the regulation. They also are very, very cheeky, Kerry, right? What they do is they say, oh, we think actually that there could be another crash. Of course, they know there is going to be, but none of the other financial analysts, for example, newspaper people, are really saying this. Only the Bank for International Settlements. So they're preparing for to be the people who come up with the solution after this happens. They're not stupid. And I think really that's where these people get off, is they see the rest of us as kind of, you know, or talking about Orwell earlier on, kind of Animal Farm, with these guys are the farmers and they're playing games with us really and trying to herd us around here and there. But the banking system is quite clearly the heart of the beast. And the BIS of anywhere on the planet is probably right where it all happens. Carney was on the Regulations Committee, which is the committee which has caused the 2008 financial crisis. And yet he's cherry-picked to come and take over the Bank of England. You couldn't make it up.
Absolutely. Well, okay. But, you know, Rothschild owns, I guess, 99% of the banks around the world anyway. So at the very top,
Queen Elizabeth has got massive shareholdings in banks. And of course, she's a massive, massive landowner too. She hides her wealth. And this is what they all do in the rich list on Forbes, the Times, Sunday Times rich list. I mean, one of my colleagues is Kevin Cahill. He has written a fantastic book called Who Owns the World? Another one I'd recommend. Which goes country by country, looking at who actually owns these countries, that is to say the vast majority of the land and the assets in those countries. And Kevin used to work for the Sunday Times on the rich list, and he explained that he wrote an article for the rich list, I think it was around about the late 1980s, early 1990s sometime, called The Rich Pay No Tax. And he was talking mostly about the Queen and various other people in this article. These are the great old days of real journalism. And then the next day, Murdoch, who owned the Times, got a call from the palace to say, oh, but they've calculated the Queen's wealth wrong. The Crown Estate is not part of the personal wealth. Well, hang on a minute, because she can buy and sell anything in the Crown Estate, so surely it is part of her personal wealth. And so what happened is, that year, the Queen slipped. The rich list had been running for a few years, and it was the first year the Queen slipped from number one on the rich list all the way down to something like 200. so that's how they fix these things. It's complete illusion.
Yeah, well, for sure. To get back to this Bank of International Settlements, though, you know, because I don't know if you heard about sort of what's been going on behind the scenes with all of that. It has to do with Indonesia and these bonds. Did you follow the story about the bonds that no, Neil Keenan was trying to trade in for the Indonesians? You know about okay, but bottom line is that bank is the guy at the top whose name is escaping me at the moment. Who runs it basically takes his orders from Rothschild. That's it.
Well, it wouldn't surprise me at all. No, I mean, one of the things Mike said to me, which rung true, is that you've got basically these two empires. The United States of America is run by the Rockefellers, and the United States of Europe is run by the Rothschilds, and their plan is to get everything together in the same hands. It just seems very, very clear. They call the Bank for International Settlements the Tower of Basel. And what many people don't realise is that up until, maybe the 1980s or maybe early 90s, it was a completely anonymous place. If you came out of Basel train station and went across the road, there was an anonymous door next to a chocolate shop, which was the entrance to the Bank for International Settlements. And above, you know, they obviously had offices above the chocolate shop. But there was nothing saying Bank for International Settlements because, of course, at the Bretton Woods Conference at the end of the Second World War, John Maynard Keynes and others had said this bank must be closed down, and they voted and they said it would, and it wasn't. It just carried on quietly above this chocolate shop for decades. And now it's come back out into the open after Keynes has died and very many people from Bretton Woods have died and can't kind of go on to the press and say, well, hang on a minute, this bank should have closed down. It was a Nazi bank. It helped launder money for Hitler. It helped Hitler get all his foreign exchange.
Yes, this is the background of BIS, correct?
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's been closed down. I mean, it is really the apex, I think, of the global bankster network and effectively a kind of cult, because you won't get the truth out of any of the people that go there. They're just there drunk on power, drunk on money, drunk on being able to take over. I mean, the thing is, what they do is any institution that speaks against them, they just buy it up and close it down. I mean, effectively, that's what they're there for. I mean, when it comes to industries here in Britain, we've seen it over the last 30, 40 years. Almost everything which is British, or was British, has been bought up and closed down, mostly bought by the Germans. That's it. They seem to have invested massively in Britain. But of course, it means all the profits then go back to them.
That's interesting. I thought also the Japanese had been investing pretty heavily, and the Chinese in Britain.
Them too as well. Yeah. But I mean, for example, our post office, it was Deutsche Bank that wanted to buy it. I mean, when I was over, one of the more interesting kind of asides, when I was over in Dresden, I had a chat to a Calvinist priest. It just so happened the hotel I was in had a beautiful Calvinist church. It's the only church apparently in Europe which used to be an armory and a cannon firing room, but they converted it into a church. And it's beautiful, absolutely beautiful place. But this guy said he used to be on the board of Deutsche Bank. And he was expressing to me privately, really, I mean, expressing concerns, saying, well, these private banks are just completely taken over, and they are completely driven by profit and greed. Whereas we saw our job as Deutsche Bank is to really facilitate the trading of the nation. And there was a completely different culture in these private banks. But Deutsche Bank itself, I'm talking about the Bundesbank, not Deutsche Bank. He was on the board of the Bundesbank, which was a state bank. You know, their job was largely benevolent, to try and facilitate the flow of resources around the country in goods and services. But he's then saying, well, you know, this is something that's really sad for me to see in my retirement, the way these private individuals are now running things. And, of course, that idea of running society for the benefit of a few private individuals, well, we all know where that goes. And that is going to have revolution, war, and massive inequalities in the society. And I think that's where we're heading.
Well, what about HSBC? Because there's a lot come out about their role as well. Have you tracked down some of that down?
Look, they pay piffling fines for whatever they do. And they've now got their director of their risk committee, which is a bit of a joke, since they take risks with people's lives and they trade them against what fine might you have to pay. Okay, well, we'll take the risk with the people's lives. We're talking about the Mexican drug cartels and this sort of thing. It is Rona Fairhead, and she is now the chairman of the BBC. So I don't think we'll be seeing any documentaries or getting any investigative journalism about HSBC with her in charge.
Right. You know, I think there was a recent article talking about HSBC and this, I guess it was a few years ago in the Rolling Stone, talking about that there was some kind of settlement with HSBC, basically proving that the drug war was a joke. And, you know, that all the stuff that goes on behind the scenes with...
Okay. HSBC in Mexico converted all their branches to receive suitcases. And they had big kind of under the counters. So you could slide your suitcase underneath to the cashier through past the bulletproof glass at the top, you know. And so they were quite clearly making a conscious, very conscious effort right from the top to facilitate drug money. And
sure.
that one of the things they said was, oh, well, the only thing that saved us during the financial crisis is because, you know, we allowed loads of money from the illegal drug markets and prostitution markets to come all through our, and we knew they were effectively mafia gangsters, but we said, oh, okay, well, you can deal with us. Now, you know, they have silly little rules and regulations to try and stop people doing money laundering, but of course the biggest money launderers in the world are HSBC, and that bank started over in Hong Kong as part of the opium trade and using opium as a weapon of war, kind of psychological warfare weapon against the Chinese all that time back, and trading and making money from, I don't think they've ever stopped making money from drugs, have they?
Probably not. And what about the Vatican Bank? Are you aware of sort of some of the background behind that bank?
Well, look, I'd just like to just in a way actually say the Catholic Church, I think, is a wonderful institution. The church itself, that is to say, the congregations that go along.
You're not serious, are you?
Many of the priests are very, very good. They're some of the most, the bravest fighters for human rights, particularly in South America, have been Archbishop Romero, for example.
With the exception of the Pope,
the Catholic Pope. Church. But once you get, and this is the big but, isn't it? Once you get to the Vatican, once you get right to the top, some of the cardinals as well, what you're dealing with is a semi-Nazi style organization, and they will do absolutely anything. These people who were running the rat lines at the end of the Second World War, they helped the Nazis out.
Right.
I think the thing is...
Have you read The Devil's Chessboard?
It's very easy to throw the baby out with the bathwater with the Catholics, because for many of the individuals I know...
Well, I mean, that goes for Jews, that goes for any group that is in a power position. Certainly we have what we call white hats, good people behind the scenes in all areas of the world, but there is a certain license to, linked up with the whole apparatus that's running the world right now, that the Catholic Church is, hand in glove, that whole organization is. So whether or not the priests themselves are relatively benign or even positive leaning, what you've got is an organization that is, orchestrating pedophilia across the globe. And it's rampant for even, I'm sure you're familiar with this. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's also true, I think, for some of the top Anglican and Protestant bishops and whatever. When we've got some guy who's the Bishop of, I think it's Bishop of Gloucester here, who's just been prosecuted. What he was doing was he had a twin brother, and his twin brother was taking services while he was, as a kind of alibi, whilst he was molesting children. So, I think it's just any kind of good institution, which the church should be, is infested with these people. It's the perfect cover for them. They see it as the perfect cover, and they use it and abuse it. But that doesn't stop some very, very wonderful and positive people being involved in the church. And, so there are obviously some brave people who've stood up to these scoundrels, criminals. And I think the Catholic Church is a particularly good example of that. I think the Protestants are a bit weak in a lot of ways, but the Catholics were. I mean, for example, one of the things I'd say, a real basic, simple thing, is that the Protestants took most of the, a lot of the best stuff out of the Bible. I mean, they couldn't take the Sermon on the Mount out. I suppose they couldn't get away with that.
Most of the Bible is full of a pack of lies. I mean, a lot of it is put together by a bunch of men who had a certain agenda.
I think essentially, particularly the
Old
Testament.
And in fact, a lot of the truth is not even in the Bible anymore.
The Old Testament is a wonderful history. You go and read it, a wonderful history of the Jewish people.
I think there are a lot of lies in there about the history of the Jewish people.
They survive against the occupation and the takeover by the Babylonians of the Jewish race and the Jewish tribes. And then they had a similar thing, didn't they, in Egypt too? The Egyptian, these massive empires. In fact, it's a good lesson for us all. The way that the Jews managed to survive against these massive empires who were trying to take them over, bring them into captivity, etc. And the Babylonian Babylonians as well, of course, their way of running things is really what we're dealing with today, a kind of Babylonian system. It was the Babylonians that invented interest, which is one of the main weapons that the banksters at the BIS...
Well, this is actually, what we call the Anunnaki. So have you read Sitchin's work at all?
No.
Oh, okay.
I have read the Bible. I've read the Old Testament.
Uh-huh. Lots of people have read the Bible. That doesn't make them particularly educated.
And I would suggest people do have a look at the Catholic Bible, which has got a whole load of stuff in there. The Book of Judith is fantastic. It's a really good read, for example. There is other things at the end of the Book of Daniel, which isn't in the Protestant Bible. So this is the point I'm trying to make is that the Protestants did a kind of makeover of the church, and that they took a lot of the interesting stuff out of it. And denuded it.
Well, maybe the blood sacrifice, for example.
They allowed Freemasonry in as well.
Okay, I think we're getting a bit off the track here. In terms of your work...
I'm going to have to go in a minute, sorry.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. Let me ask, we do have a chat room here alongside this show, and it is a live show. So let me ask the people if they have any questions for you right before you leave. if you don't mind. And as far as what's going on, do you have any thoughts about the what is in essence this farce that we call the American election?
Oh, isn't it awful? you know, I actually think I am. I mean, it seems like everyone is being steered, anyone with intelligence, to go for Trump. But I'm not at all sure that that's going to be a wise thing. I think, is it William Engdahl, I think, wrote a really brilliant article about Trump a couple of months ago called A Mafia Don with a Pompadour. And that was the headline. And, you know, Hillary Clinton is such a toxic, toxic brand. I don't know why or how on earth any sane Democrat could be trying to put her forward as someone who people might want to vote for. It's a joke. I mean, I think actually she's a kind of Lady Macbeth figure who's so absolutely overawed with the idea of power that she's the worst enemy to herself. You know, that really is Lady Macbeth. There are actually some great stuff on the, if you go on the internet and put Lady Macbeth, Hillary Clinton, and you'll see some great images of her trying to put the crown on her head, you know.
Sure.
That's the way with Hillary. I mean, it's also worth saying that she was at the Bilderberg Conference, I think it was in 2008, when Obama got his first nomination as a Democratic frontrunner. And she was brought into the Bilderberg Conference secretly, although it was leaked afterwards, to be told, basically, no, you're going to have to stand aside this time. Bilderberg's told her. And we'll give you a chance to run next time. So I guess that what's happening is they're fulfilling their promise to let her run.
But yes, we were told this as well.
That is not, you know, she is not really in any way a credible candidate. She's a criminal, and she's a war criminal, and she's a proven known liar. And so nobody in their right mind would ever think of voting for her. So, you know, this is how bad it's got in this so-called democracy. But I would also point at Trump as being a very unpredictable character. I think I was actually in up in Staffordshire in the sort of central West England, just near Wales, recently at an RAF museum, and they had all the old V-bombers in there from the Cold War that used to have the British nuclear bombs underneath them sort of patrolling around and that sort of thing. And they had a brilliant diorama display thing where you walk into this booth and it takes you through all of the kind of newsreel footage and some of the statements and facts and RAF personnel talking about what was going on during the Cold War and at the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I was sitting there at the end of it. My wife turned to me and she said, well, what would have happened if Trump had been in charge instead of Kennedy? And I think that says it all, really.
Okay, I am scanning, you know, four questions here. So somebody wants to know what you think the economic collapse will look like. And let me say that having spent quite a bit of time in Britain in the last couple of years myself, I think that there is a huge sort of gap in between what you call, well, the rather very rich and the sort of rest of Britain. I think that things are much worse in Britain than people are really aware of. What do you think about all that?
Well, first of all, it's not in our press, hardly at all. There is no witness of what's going on with people starving, living on food banks, having to beg for their food, etc., beg for money on the streets, and this kind of thing. It's a massive increase in eviction from people's homes. And when you talked about me being a land rights activist at the beginning, I mean, I'm a big advocate of actively resisting eviction. I don't think eviction should ever happen. I don't think there's ever an excuse to turn someone out of their home. It's absolutely quite right to barricade a house, I think, if someone... I mean, I've been seeing a lot of the... I don't think it's quite as bad here in the UK, but people, for example, in Detroit being turfed out of their homes. So there's whole areas where there's beautiful houses, but they've just been allowed to fall into disrepair because people have been evicted from them. Now, look, this is just idiotic. You know, let people live in a home. Let them have a home to live in. Isn't that the sort of thing that... that America was started for, built on, you know, the idea that you can, you know, carve out a little bit of land and build somewhere to live there. This is actually, I mean, and the whole housing thing is a total scam. The actual cost of building a house, when you're paying rent for it or a mortgage for it, you're paying something like 20 times what it costs to build. Now, that's not fair. You know, it's not right. And it's only because we need our housing so much that there's lots of techniques used to kind of bully us to pay far more over the odds than we should be for it.
Sure. But in terms of the overall economic, the question was kind of aimed a little more widely than that. How do you feel that the, let's just say the economic collapse, you're seeing it in America. It certainly seems to be happening behind the scenes in Britain. And I know in Europe, I mean, we know about Greece, et cetera, and some of this is being orchestrated. Do you have any thoughts on sort of the look of it?
We have one good thing, and that's we've kept the pound. We've got our own currency. So there is a certain amount of control from the UK about what happens here. Although, of course, many of the banks are exposed, massively exposed, just like they were in 2008. So it could go crash, bang, wallop. I think it's a kind of slow crash going on. So, you know, if you go into the city centre here in Bristol, you'll find many empty shops now. In fact, what's happened is the big shopping malls, we've just had the first charity shop opened in one of those, you know, because there's nobody who's actually able to trade. They can't make a living running a shop anymore. And the reason for that is simply because people don't have the spending power in their pockets. Sometimes you go out of an evening to a pub and you find there's nobody there, hardly anybody there, because people don't have the money to spend.
Yeah, that's what I hear when I'm in Britain. It's quite interesting.
That's the slow crash, right? But at any point that the banks just want to, they can turn that into a fast crash. That is to say where the jobs just go and people have just got to try and pay the rent. But how are they going to pay the rent? They can't pay the rent. And they've got to pay the electricity bills, et cetera, et cetera. How are you going to live? What is happening is, I think, most of the population are being frozen out, and it's just a tiny elite which this world is being run for. And that's where I think that's going to happen when that will certainly sort the sheep from the goats, won't it? The people who have good spirit and good heart, public spirited, from those who are just money grabbing and are going to go after their own. There's actually a BBC series made in the 1970s called The Survivors. Which was a brilliant kind of apocalyptic series.
Yes, I saw a bit of it, I think.
You've seen a bit of that. Well, yeah, I mean, there were several others, actually. There's another one called Doomwatch. And it's funny because I think the Brits, in a way, weird way, in the 70s, had a kind of prescience that something like this was going to happen. Doomwatch as well, which is kind of about corruption and pollution and poisonings and this sort of thing. And another one, which is an allegory, about fighting a fascist empire, which is called Blake 7, which is a kind of space odyssey, a bit like Star Trek, where the Federation are the bad guys, if you can imagine that.
Right.
And there was a lot of this kind of real brilliant creative stuff, and I think that is still in a lot of our veins and our blood here in Britain. And we're almost kind of expecting this to happen sometime. But then I think that crash, when it does happen, the big crash, will be blamed on something which has happened just before. In other words, a kind of war incident of some sort, you know, whatever, wherever it kicks off, they'll say, oh, the crash, oh, well, it's the fault of the war. But actually, of course, the evil empire has orchestrated both of them.
Well, let me ask you where you're going with your own research at this time. I'm curious, you know, you've seemed to have your finger on the pulse of what's going on in terms of the mainstream news, certainly. You're an investigative journalist. What are you really investigating at this time?
I'll point to a couple of things. One is the coup which is going on in the Labour Party here, which is very, very interesting. You've got a whole bunch of Blairites which have been put in as MPs over the last, 20 years or so since Blair. And they're quite part of the system, really. They're not, I don't think, really acting for ordinary Labour, even ordinary Labour members. They've had a rejection of Jeremy Corbyn, the leader, and there's a whole leadership contest going on. We'll see how that goes. But it may well split the Labour Party. So it just has happened in New Zealand, where you had a kind of left wing and right wing. The right wing are making mess as much as they can at the moment in the Labour Party. And I think Jeremy Corbyn as a leader is an absolutely credible winner in the next general election. He's a well-known figure. He's he's very well-respected. He's a very, very personable guy.
What you're talking about is taking down Jeremy Corbyn. So
what they're saying is he's unelectable. They're trying to take him down precisely because he is electable.
Okay.
So they're lying about that. So that's one of the things I'd point to here, which we've been doing some research on and looking into the sort of implications of that. The other thing I'd say is the paedophile scandal. It was the last weekend was the 20th anniversary of the first arrests in the Dutroux trial in Belgium, in Brussels. which is, of course, the headquarters of NATO, the headquarters of the EU, this paedophiling was going on there. And it was just interesting to see that there was just no coverage whatsoever about this 20th anniversary in the British press at all. And yet we've got our own paedophile inquiry where they've just put a woman in charge of this, the fourth chairman of this inquiry. Of course, it's going to be a complete and utter load of rubbish, this inquiry. Most of the survivors of child sexual abuse would not trust an inquiry which has had four different people running it, because they'll be wondering, well, when is this next person I'm talking to? Can I trust them? They may be going soon. And so, of course, it's just an attempt to kick it out. There's a cover-up, you know, kick it up and kick it into the long grass, where you've got a lot of evidence that there are senior conservatives, mostly, been involved in paedophilia over the years. And that's something I think which is, you know, we've looked at. There's one thing I point to is Kinkora Boys Home in Northern Ireland, where you've got evidence, very strong evidence, that politicians were being entrapped there to have fun with young boys, some with young girls as well, and were just filmed, and then that was just used to blackmail them. So that's where we. That's why I say there's a criminal elite, a gangster elite, a Bilderberg gangster elite, if you want, running the world, because sure. Well, not quite the world, certainly trying to run the Western world, Europe and America. And that's what I point to as a kind of, you know, an obvious example. Blackmail is perfect, isn't it? So when someone works their way up through politics, you then show them, oh, we've got these pictures of you. It's going to be in the Daily Mail tomorrow unless you do what we tell you.
Right. Very simple. Listen, what about Theresa May? Do you have anything to say about the new British Prime Minister?
She's a husband is an investment bank. He works for an investment bank. I mean, this is a bankster government we've got. I don't know confidence in them whatsoever. I don't know how long they're going to last. They seem to think they're going to last until 2020. We've also got in the background brewing, supposedly, a massive police investigation into Conservative election fraud from 2010. There's something like 20 constituencies where it's clear they overspent. They lied about how much money they'd spent. So those people that did lie should be arrested. But I suppose in Britain, you just have to say, oh, don't hold your breath, because the police are notorious for just not doing anything about these kinds of crimes. It may be that this does actually go to court and that some of these people are, and these election results are overturned, because if they are, there is no Conservative government anymore.
Right. I'm seeing one headline saying that Theresa May has shut the climate change department. What do you think she's going on with that?
Well, I just think that she thought it was she's incorporating the whole climate change agenda into the Department of the Environment, which I think is actually a fairly sensible thing to do. It means a bit more joined up thinking. But you've got particularly, I think, bad bunch of people. It's quite clear that I don't think there's much real discussion around the cabinet table. People nowadays are just told this is what we're going to do. That's the end of the story.
Okay. Thank you so much, Tony. I know we've kept you for a while. I think that there are some questions here, but,
If you've got another couple of questions, go for it. Go on.
Oh, very good. Okay. No problem. So do you have a thought on who and whether, I'm not sure this is, terribly logical, but, will remove Rockefeller and Rothschild from control of the world?
Well, I think there's only one of the Russians I met actually at the Bilderberg conference said this exact. He said the only person standing up to Bilderberg in the world is Putin. And I have to agree with him. I mean, it's only because the NATO forces have basically taken all the countries which are fairly non-aligned, and they're now banging up against Russia. In Syria, I mean, the Russians have got a naval base at Tarsus, and they've got air bases there as well, and they need to keep control of those bases. They can't allow the West to roll over those, and so that they've reached a deadline with that, and Putin is not going to allow them to cross the Rubicon, so they're stymied by him. So I mean, if anyone is going to topple this power elite that we've got here, C. Wright Mills wrote about back in the 1950s, a great American author, is going to be Putin.
Okay, fair enough. So this move, again, to get back to Turkey, moving closer to in alignment with Putin after what actually came to what very close to sort of blows and really a coup against, Erdogan in Turkey. This is an interesting about face. I have to say there's got to be more behind the scenes going on.
It isn't about face, not yet anyway. I think, it's a bit of a rapprochement with Russia, and I don't think the Turks are going to go to war with Russia, which is what the Pentagon would love them to do. But it's certainly a change of alignment. And although Erdogan blames Gulen for the coup, I think he's really pointing a finger at the Pentagon. He's saying, look, guys, you want to deal with me, you're going to have to be a bit smarter than that, because the coup didn't work, did it?
Well, it doesn't appear to have. However, I wonder, because we had seen, we had actually been traveling in Turkey, going down to Göbekli Tepe just before all of this went on. And I have to say that it is interesting that the coup took place. It seems to have failed. And yet perhaps it was a shot across the bow, as they say. A warning to Erdogan.
I think it was a serious attempt to kill Erdogan or to get him to leave the country or whatever. I don't think it was just they were just playing around at all.
Is exactly what a shot across the bow would be. However, the question is why he ended up, being back in power. What kind of concessions he might have made behind the scenes in order to have sort of reasserted himself.
Well, no, I think I think he's in control, actually, in Turkey, Erdogan. And, what's happened is there's been a whole kind of coming together of civil society and all the different political parties in Turkey to support him. Not necessarily to support him as an individual, but to support his right to run the country. He's made a lot of mess.
He's basically a dictator, though, for all intents and purposes.
Well, he's an elected dictator, so there's a bit of a difference there.
Yeah, well, what is an election nowadays anyway?
I'm not a big supporter of Erdogan, but, you just have to let these people run their country and then maybe get them out at a future election. It's for the Turkish people to decide. It's not for me and you to decide.
I'm not trying to decide, but I am trying to investigate further as to what's really going on here with regard to the coup and what really went on there, because I think there's a lot that is not being put out there. And this interesting situation with Russia just sort of highlights that.
I just point to the body language. If you look at the meeting last week, I think it was beginning of last week, between Erdogan and Putin, body language was very frosty. I don't think that they're going to give each other a great big hug anytime
okay,
soon.
Yeah,
I
well, mean, fair enough.
He's got gangsters. I think, the British Prime Minister's a gangster. US President's a gangster. Erdogan's a gangster. They're
sure.
All
yeah.
I don't see any of them as really being. I mean, I actually point the finger at the Iranians. I mean, they are probably lesser gangsters, but they seem to be one of the positive forces in the world at the moment.
Okay. Who seems to be a positive force at the moment? Sorry, I missed that.
The Iranians. They are one of the oldest civilizations on the planet, and they've had this kind of stuff for thousands of years. They've had to put up with it. And I think they did a fantastic job in kicking the American Shah out in 1979. And they suffered horribly for it. Something like 15,000 victims of terrorism since 1979 internally in Iran, which nobody ever seems to mention. With the US and British sponsored terrorist gangs.
Yes, absolutely.
And they're fairly wise. And I actually met some of the mullahs who were quite nice guys. They were quite personable. And I even got a selfie with them, and some big smiles. They were quite nice. And even though they couldn't speak English, only Arabic, they don't even speak Farsi. They were decent chaps when I went over there last year. I've got a lot of time for the Iranians. The other, another country which I think is positive, maybe we can end on a positive note, is although it seems to be going down a bit recently, is Malaysia with their independence. It's an old British colony. And I think that they've taken some of the best from the way that British ruled, and they're instituting that there. You know, so there are some good places around the world. I don't think that Europe.
Well, when you're talking about the people, that's one thing. If you're talking about their rulers, it's another. I think you really have to get down to that.
The regimes in these two countries, I think, are a little bit better than many other, certainly where we are here. We get a good lifestyle here. But the rulers, I think, are basically against us. You know, that's what we need to just sort out our system so we can have some people running affairs, making laws, controlling the way that our taxpayers' money is spent, who are actually working in our interest, which would be a miracle here.
Yes, absolutely. So just as a wrap-up question, some people are asking, in terms of Brexit, what is your feeling about it? I mean, you've kind of already said that you think perhaps it's not really going to happen. Do you think it will split up Britain, or do you think that it's basically not going to go through?
Look, I mean, I haven't really got a crystal ball here, Kerry, but I think that there's going to be a big effort.
No, but your opinion is, you know.
They've got big efforts by the elites. And really, a lot of this will hinge on whether Jeremy Corbyn succeeds to carry on for the next few years to the next general election as leader of the Labour Party. If he does, I think we will get proper Brexit, because he will be a servant of the people. He is going to actually do what the people ask for at the referendum, because he believes in the democratic will of the people. I think this is one of the things if it doesn't happen, that means that the elites have just done what they wanted with Britain. So I don't know how that's all going to go. We really can't tell.
But a lot. Well, I mean, if you understand. Well, I mean, you're saying Jeremy Corbyn. I think, you know, his chances of actually winning an election are slim to none.
No, I totally don't buy into that at all. He's got enormous popular support in this country. In fact, here in Bristol, under his leadership, we had the first ever Labour mayor elected here. Just in May this year, the same in London. You've now got a Labour mayor in London under Jeremy Corbyn. There's almost all of the regional elections that have happened, the local elections, Labour did very well.
Okay.
A couple of places. I mean, he's actually very well liked. But there's a lot.
But not by the people behind the scenes that are in the. And you know, we're talking about the Rothschilds again. Look, they fixed the vote. It goes on in Britain as well.
I totally disagree with you about fixing the vote. The other thing is, in Scotland.
Well, I have whistleblower testimony to this effect.
A very powerful Scottish National Party in Scotland. The other thing is that Labour has been pretty much pushed out of Scotland by the SNP. But the trouble is that the Scottish people are getting annoyed with the SNP now. So somebody like Jeremy Corbyn, as a real kind of alternative to this sham, these various sham parties which are working for the elites, is that the Labour Party could become a resurgent in Scotland, which would be fascinating to see what that would do, you know, bringing back loads and loads of MPs, Labour MPs coming from Scotland, because the SNP have overplayed their hand. And I'm just giving you my own political analysis, having been covering politics in this country for the last, 6-7 years, that I think that there's a real fear amongst the elites of Corbyn. They will do anything to try and get rid of him. It may even possibly bump him off, like they did with, it looks like possibly with Robin Cook and another Labour leader, John Smith, back in the early 1990s. And even Tony Benn apparently was poisoned when he was running to be deputy leader of the Labour Party, so that he couldn't get into any kind of powerful political positions. And so the Labour Party, I think, is the key to resisting the New World Order, because they actually do in many ways represent ordinary people, ordinary working people, and actually quite a lot of people who are middle class and wealthy respect Corbyn, because he's a personable guy, and he says what he thinks, and that's very rare for a politician.
Okay, fair enough. All right, Tony, thank you so much for really covering the gamut here, and you know, you've been a great sport, and thanks for bearing with us.
Waiting for such a long time from the Bilderberg conference to actually for me getting around to coming on your show.
Absolutely. So thank you again, and let's do this again in the near future. Whenever you have something you'd like to talk to, you know, the people about here, we have quite a good audience, and this will go on to YouTube, and people will be able to see it just after we quit here. So it's great to have you on the show.
Okay, Kerry, bless you. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Take care.